Tonight on Arena, we explore the life of patron of the arts Peggy Guggenheim, an alien Romulus, Kneecap and Only the River Flows are our films for review. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. To begin, we have a fantastic competition and we'll give you time to enter by telling you about it just before we start our film reviews. On Thursday, September the 12th, the RTE Concert Orchestra and conductor Stephen Bell will bring the musical world of Bond, James Bond, to the National Concert Hall for one night only. Guest vocalists Oliver Tomsett and Rachel Wooding and conductor Stephen Bell celebrate Goldfinger's 60th anniversary with a suite of iconic James Bond themes. And we have a pair of tickets to give away to the show along with an overnight stay at the Spencer Hotel in Dublin, just a few minutes stroll from the heart of the city. To be in with a chance to win this prize, text your name and the answer to the following question to 51551. I will announce the winner at the end of the programme. Which Beatle performed the theme song for the James Bond film Live and Let Die? So text us the answer to that to 51551 and I'll let you know the answer at the end of the show and the winner, of course. Now, tonight on Arena, we have film reviews, yet more aliens, a hard day's hip hop and a Chinese noir thriller. Well, Kneecap haven't been on the scene that long, but their much anticipated biopic opened in cinemas at the weekend, starring Michael Fassbender and Simon Kirby, as well as the notorious two rappers Makara and Mowgli Bap, and the masked DJ Provy. Ridley Scott's Alien spawned one of the most enduring of sci-fi horror series in cinema history. Mr. Scott may not be at the helm directing anymore, but the adventures and horror continue in Alien Romulus, starring Hollywood's woman of the moment, Kaylee Spaney. And the absorbing Chinese neo-noir thriller Only the River Flows is set in the 1990s and has things to say about the contemporary world. Arlene Hunt and John Maguire have been to the movies for us and join me now in studio. But first to Kneecap, which is in cinemas now, let's listen to what makes them so distinctive. This is Sick in the Head.
I got a point to be proven to myself. Sitting too long, getting moldy on the shelf, cause I'm too far gone when it comes to mental health. Rather be sick in the head with a little bit of wealth. Time I tender right, I got a cool strange. My time can do yan and they need to sit down. I get relaxed when I get shit, we can't. Never go live by your guest, I can show them all.
Shots again, to your good, yeah, they're doing it to you constantly. An individual is surely what you want to be. You're born to sound good, live your fantasy. Before they eat you up, respect your earth and lethargy. Fun sucker, BG for suckers, clean it off, blind mucker. They'll be pushed back, but relax, shocker. Cause shoulders feel sad, they heal at the uns, brother.
It's a philosophy, me like I'm gone, don't worry. I'll go live in, I'm an ear, heal a power and TV, Steve. To be a fact to me, because Khabibah, Tyler's daughter is always how it's meant to be. So got your cogger.
That's Sick in the Head from Kneecap, and their origin film is called Kneecap. Or so, John, they say this is the origin film of the band. It's more of a caper, isn't it?
It is a caper. I suppose this is a riotous film. It's an uproarious film. I really enjoyed it. And it's the origin story for the Belfast rappers, who just released their debut album, Fine Art. And it's co-written by the band and the director, Rech Pipiat. And it stars themselves. This is the great coup of this, is that the first thing I did when I went home after watching it was see who played the actor, who were the actors in it. And to discover that they play themselves, Mowgli Bap, Makara and DJ Provy, the guy in the balaclava. To me, that's the great coup de cinema here, is that they're actually playing themselves. And the ensemble cast of veterans around them, Michael Fassbender and Simone Kirby. It's set in West Belfast in 2019. We meet an Irish teacher, an Irish language activist, J.J. O'Doherty, when he's called by the police to attend an interview with a young hoodlum who will only speak Osceola. And soon, and to the horror of his wife, the teacher is abandoning his career in education to make beats for these two rappers slash drug dealers in his shed. And the three of them start playing.
He was an old DJ before, wasn't he?
He has an interest in making beats and spinning wheels, But this is a complete turnaround for this man. He completely changes his life over the course of a single night of fun and games with these two. And they start playing gigs in back rooms, in pubs. And hip-hop is inherently political. We just heard the song, a clip from the song there is about mental health, you know, and they're rapping in Irish, which is, you know, makes it harder again for them. That's neither profitable nor popular. And it's legitimate protest music and kneecap rap in the Irish language, which, like I say, is not something you hear every day.
Yes, because it was the Language Act kind of inspired the themes in the film.
Absolutely.
Wasn't it?
This is really a film about identity, and language is the main theme. And how can this be a dead language when this film is so very much alive? And more to that, the script is composed of real life stories that the band told Pepiat, who wrote them down and stitched them together. Now, some of the stories are real in the sense that they may have happened in their imaginations, but they're still real to them, or they might have happened to a friend of theirs, or they might be something that they heard on the streets. And, you know, the way they rap in Irish and they promote the Irish language as one strand of their resistance. And the film, you know, there's a character, Fassbender's character, Arlo, who's a former IRA volunteer who dies simply because everybody says that he's dead. That's the power of the language that they're using. You know, it ends with a title card that tells us that a native language dies every 40 days. And, you know, they're trying to ascertain their own identities through the language that they speak and the context of their, you know, the life that they have on the streets. And to me, that's incredibly powerful. And to be able to do that in a film that's funny and smart and full of great music and full of energy and vibrancy, you know, to me, that's a great coup.
Now, Arlene, John there thought that the three lads in Kneecap were being played by actors, and they are interacting with a great actor and a great star like Michael Fassbender and our own Simone Kirby, obviously. Did that work for you, that mix of the band and the and movie stars?
I wasn't quite as taken with the acting of the two main rappers, you know, Bap and Akara Mokara. It wasn't like, the energy is there for sure. There's a lot of energy behind this, and there's a lot of, you know, this is not a movie for the faint-hearted. I think I should point out there were two people behind me in the screening that I went to, two older people who had wandered in. And they hadn't ribbons what was going on at all. But I did hear one of them lean across to the other one and just go, well, it's very raunchy. So it's not for a faint-hearted, this, but it's full of energy. It's full of mischief. It's good to have people like Simone and Fassbender behind it, because they give it, they connect it much better. If it had been all just sort of, you know, up-and-coming actors or younger or first-time actors, I don't think it would have worked as well. I just think when you have the gravitas of that story, because Arlo is away for 10 years, as John said, supposedly Maria dead. You know, but he is dead to his wife. She says it in the film at one point, like, he's dead to me. And, you know, there's a kind of poignancy there as well, but behind just the language, you know, there's the grief and everything that they've all had. The lads at the start of the film said they have PTSD, but not from the Troubles, but because of what their family life wrought and what the streets have wrought for them. So, you know.
And Arlene, it is quite irreverent to both sides in the conflict, both to the nationalist side,
sure,
and the loyalist side. Do you think that, you know, audience are ready for that?
I think so. I don't see why not. I think people would be prepared for it, because they're coming at it from a very young culture. They're not coming at it from people who went through the 70s, 80s. Mm-hmm. You know, they're coming at it from a very different aspect. They're coming at it from where they are in their culture now, where the streets have changed, where it's not like before. You know, one of the lads has a Protestant girlfriend in this, which was unheard of before, and actually a lot of their foreplay is very much intermingled,
yes,
and very funny, very funny. But it's a lot to do, like, on one side of the fence and on t'other. So, and that's actually very hilarious.
Well, they're equal opportunity offenders, really. And through the music, and now through this film, Kneecap are trying to open a conversation. Then the approach might be to kick down a few doors along the way, but their intentions are sweetly sincere. It doesn't matter how rude they are and how much bad languages in it. They really are sincere in when they're talking about language and identity and youth culture and the reality of life on the streets in post-Troubles Northern Ireland. It's all there. It's really very cleverly reflected.
Let's listen to a clip. In this sequence from Kneecap, our two heroes, Mokara and Mowgli Bap, talk us through the impact of the Troubles on young people and their strong language at the end of this clip.
Called our generation the ceasefire babies. As if our only defining feature was we were not the shit that came before us. Maybe they were right. Maybe we were only ever gonna be the moment after the moment. just as fucked up and miserable as the last, only with less chance of getting blown up to escape it all. But we still found ways to escape it all. You've heard of intergenerational trauma, right?
Right.
Our history?
Our history has become
our biology.
It's like the trauma our ancestors suffered
has inserted itself.
It's actually inserted itself into our genetic code. Post-traumatic stress disorder.
Psychological reverberations.
ADHD. ODD.
The troubles?
The troubles? I've got fucking troubles.
A clip there from Kneecap. Arlene, I think you're only mugglor about this.
I like the energy. I will say that I like the energy and I think has a lot going for it. You know, I wish I knew a bit more about the lads. Like, we know about Arlo and his family, but we don't know anything about Mokara. I don't know, apart from he's obviously got a family because someone keeps his tracksuits clean. That's about as much as I can tell you about him. I don't know anything else. So, you know, and a weird point of balance then, you know, so you know a lot about one, you know, a lot about JJ and you know nothing about this other fella. So it is, I think the balance of it was a bit off for me. But I liked the energy. I liked the wild ride effect of it, which I thought was really interesting. And I laughed out loud in lots of sections. I was also with my hand over mouth in a lot of sections. There's a lot of drug taking in this, but it's actually quite funny the way it's been handled as well. There's one particular scene where they're all turned into plasticine Mala characters because they're taking ketamine. It's just it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. So yeah, so it's I you know, Mokalore. 3 out of 5, I'll take it.
3 out of 5 from you and for you, John.
Well, for me, it was like a cross between one of those kind of gritty kitchen sink dramas that you're used to seeing from Northern Ireland and, you know, a rude cartoon that likes a Ralph Bashki from the 70s. It's really a very clever mix. 4 out of 5 for me. I enjoyed it and I look forward to seeing another one. And good luck to them at the Oscars. This is the official Irish entry for the best international film at the Oscars.
As good a chance as Colin Kuhn?
I don't know. But if they got nominated, I think that would be an absolute scoop. And if one of their songs got nominated for Best Original Song as well, I think that would be an extraordinary thing to happen.
Okay, now we'll move on to Alien Romulus, the latest installment of the Alien series, which of course started way back in 1979. This one, made by this seasoned horror director, Fede Alvarez, sees the heirs of the original Weyland Yutani employees grapple with a similarly drooling and unpleasant extraterrestrials. So set the scene for us, Arlene. Where are we in the space-time contending here?
Well, it's a mining. They're on a mining planet before. There's two guys, two girls. Three girls, two guys, and an android. Now, the android belongs to the main character, Rain. Her father found it on the dump and he reconfigured him so that he would always look after Rain. So they're living in a pretty dystopian, very, very dark planet, and they get an idea, or they get wind of what they think is a spaceship which is unmoored and unmanned just off their planet. And so they arrange it with their own group and their own little spaceship to go out to it and see if they can find time-travelling pods on it so that they can go to a different planet and get away, because it takes so long to go between interplanetary travel. Takes so long. You need to put yourself into stasis before you can travel. And they're not allowed to go. So this is an undercover mission that they've decided to do. They think they're going out to a spacecraft. It's not. It's a space station, which has been dismanned, disbarred. It's running on nothing. And so they're like, OK, well, we're still going to break in, because they could see on their comms that there's still travel pods within there. So the two of the lads go into, if you're claustrophobic, by the way, this will make the center of your palm sweat. They go through the ducts to go into the space station, because obviously none of the doors and stuff work. And as they're going in there, if you're a fan of this genre and if you're a fan of this particular franchise, you know that when you're going into something that looks dead and it looks
it's going to be alien somewhere,
it's not going to be good. Yeah. You're going to wake up what you do not want to wake up. Mm-hmm. And so and it is so.
And John, does this go back to the Ridley Scott, the original Alien, because in style and in storyline?
Well, this is the great thing about these kind of franchise intellectual properties, is that they have gaps, time gaps. You saw that with the Predator Prey film, that they discovered a gap. You see it with Star Wars all the time, particularly the TV spin-offs for Star Wars. So it's not quite a sequel. It's not quite a prequel. It's kind of a midquel. And it's a spin-off that sits in this 57-year gap between Ridley Scott's 1979 original and James Cameron's Aliens, the follow-up. And that kind of space isn't going to lie dormant for very long. And that's what they're trying to fill here. But more than just accomplishing that neat task of returning it to these gritty beginnings, like Arlene said, after the, you know, dead ends of Ridley Scott's last two big budget installments, it's kind of a throwback to the series' origins as a haunted house movie. It's kind of a seat-gripping horror that swaps out spooky ghosts for these drippy, toothy monsters from another planet. And to me, that part of the film, the first half of the film, works really well. They get there, like Arlene described. They wake up the beasts, and then they have to start running. And it's that at that point, around the halfway point, that the film starts to slide a little bit. But up to then, this is Alien all the way through. It's Ridley Scott's vision for Alien transferred through this guy, Fede Alvarez.
Okay, I hope this clip is from the good bit. Here, Kaylee Spaney's Rain, along with her cyborg brother, Andy, who Arlene explained, played by David Johnson, and her ex-boyfriend, Tyre, played by Archie Reno, arm themselves against the predators at their door. There's strong language in this clip also.
Wait. Do you see it? There.
Fucking thing's hunting us.
Right. New plan. Can you manage yourself with the gun?
Yes, I fucking can.
Right, this is an F-44 AA pulse rifle. It's rotating breech electronic pulse action. It's what the Colonial Marines used. AA stands for aiming assist. So, right, you put that under your arm. That's it. Right, this hand in.
Aim it towards Andy. Pull the trigger halfway. Don't worry, the safety's on. Aiming assistance. That thing comes towards you. You point it in this general direction, you'll never miss.
Where'd you learn all this?
Games and magazines.
Kaylee Spaney there, Arlene playing the role of Rain. Is she a kind of Ripley?
She would be the Ripley of the group. Yeah, she would be the Ripley. Absolutely. Because she's reluctant to go at the very start. And then she just kind of goes along because, you know, she's kind of sucked in with the crew. She's quite brave. You know, she's willing to go back for her friend. She has a complicated relationship with the people on board. She has a complicated relationship with Andy, who is initially this kind of teddy bear of an android, which is probably the best way I can describe him. You know, he's been prescribed, he blinks, he's awkward, he's, you know, he's been designed or reprogrammed by her father, you know, to look after her. And then there's a great scene in it where she uploads a different program into his system because he gets badly damaged while on the station. And he immediately becomes a very different type. You can hear it in his voice there, a bit different type of android. And he is met, do you remember Rook from the first one, the very first one, played by Ian Holm?
Yes,
of course. There's a kind of recreation of Rook in this. And Rook works for the company. He does not have the concerns of humans. And it's very apparent very quickly that when you upload this kind of information into Andy, the concerns of the company come first and not the concerns of humans.
So there's all kinds of nods
and
fun for those who know the original.
Yeah, that's what the Uruguayan filmmaker Alvarez is really trying to do here, Kay, is showcase the most enduring elements of this franchise. So you get H.R. Giger's smooth skull xenomorphs, plenty of those, Death from the Shadows. You get the, like Arlene says, the corporation's artificial humans, including that one surprise franchise return, and the strong female lead in that. But again, more than that, it's the world that they're creating here feels very Aliens.
Stars from you, John?
You're looking for stars. Three for me, I think, Kay. I like this film, but there's the sense of it being a kind of a hybrid spliced from two already connected roots. And it suits ultimately where Romulus ends up, but it makes the film feel at times more like a clever remix than a standalone story of its own origins.
Are you more enthusiastic, I think, Arlene?
I gave it 3 out of 5 as well because I think it's a film of two halves. I really, really, like John, really enjoyed the first half and the world building in the first half, and then I just felt it slid a little bit off the mantle in the second. But it's a very entertaining film nonetheless, and I think it will bring
it's a
new
fans. Film as well,
and I think it'll bring. Really good at scary. I think it'll bring new fans to the franchise as well after Prometheus and some of those.
Okay, 3 stars from both of you for Alien Romulus, and Stephen Benedict will be talking to us on Monday about all things Alien. And finally, we go to Only the River Flows, the big screen adaptation of a popular novella. The action here is set in 1995, as the modern China we recognise today is only emerging. Detective Ma Jie is investigating the murder of an elderly woman, but the evidence doesn't chime with his gut instinct. This is a completely different tone, isn't it, John?
Well, it's a totally different film. This is Chinese neo-noir. They've made a lot of these kind of films over the last decade or so. And like you say, Kay, it's set in 1995, after the death of Deng Xiaoping and at the start of this massive economic activity that became like really where they just tore the place down and rebuilt it. And it's basically the film is set on a building site in this unnamed city. But most of the action takes place beside the river that flows through the villages around the city. And Ma Jie, who's played by this brilliantly world-weary actor named Zhu Yilong, he's investigating this murder. He's given the case. He's told to relocate his office to an abandoned cinema, which is closed down because nobody goes to it anymore. He sets up a desk in the old projection booth. And there's a suggestion right from the start that the kind of shiny fiction that we're about to watch, that was screened from a room like this onto a screen like that, is going to stand at odds with the kind of tawdry, dirty, more mundane and less easily explained story that we're about to hear. Because this is not smooth sailing. This is a complex story. It's really, there's two parallel stories. There's the investigation into the murder, which isn't that complicated. There's further deaths that happen as Ma makes his way through this kind of labyrinth of suspects, gets his clues together, follows his leads, all that kind of police procedural. And at the same time, you have another story, which is Ma, who is collapsing, basically, under the strain from his superiors, the strain of the case, his obsession with the deaths, the collapse of his marriage, etc., etc.
Yes, because he is in trouble in his marriage, and that is an important line in the story.
He's due his first baby. His wife is pregnant. Bai is pregnant. It's their first child. It's obviously very much a wanted child, but they go along and they have this awful genetic testing, where I thought it was the cruelest scene in the whole film, where the geneticist is disinterested in them and suggested to them that their child probably has some sort of chromosomal anomaly, 10%, but very high likely that this child has it. And she doesn't even look at them when she's delivering this news, which is devastating news. And they, you know, he Captain Ma is devastated over it, but he suggests to his wife that perhaps they should have an abortion. And they can try again. And she is appalled and horrified by and furious at this, because she will never have this child again. And so that pressure is building on top of him the whole time. He never stops. He doesn't sleep much. He smokes constantly. His superiors are on his back about, like, you know, wrap this case up. And the levels of pressure he's under are phenomenal.
And John, is the case itself sufficiently engaging as well?
I think so, yeah. It's kind of one that he's going to mope and brood over. It's because as a character, he's really acting on instinctive judgments that go against his training in some cases, but he relies really on vibes and atmospheres for a direction. He doesn't ask a lot of questions. He kind of walks into rooms and tries to absorb
surmises,
the energy.
Surmises things.
He's a very laid-back kind of guy, but classic film noir is the cinema of crisis and confusion. And that's really what we're dealing with here, is the kind of increasingly surreal image-making joins with this deteriorating state of mind, and it's burnished by this beautifully grainy photography. So a real note of melancholy and fatalism sets in here about halfway through. And although it might be set in the past, it's really a film that addresses contemporary social and cultural China.
I'm guessing that you both like this. Stars from you, Arlene.
I gave it 4 out of 5. I really enjoyed it. Should point out, it's a slow build, this one. If you're into your sort of Beverly Hills Cop crime thing, this is not it.
Yes, no, it didn't sound like
no,
that.
It isn't. But it's very absorbing.
And from you, John?
A 4 for me too, Kay. I think it's really influenced by the LA thrillers of the 1990s, which may be a topic for another day. But it's fascinating to trace that over and back across the Pacific between what Hollywood was doing, how the Asian cinema adapted it, And changed it, and how that then influenced Hollywood as well.
And it has,
and he's really in that conversation.
It has the same weather as Seven all the way through.
Oh, yeah, very much so. And there is that jet stream of influences over and back across the Pacific that makes it all the more interesting.
Well, I think that's an endorsement. 4 out of 5 for Only the River Flows. John McGuire and Arlene Hunt, thank you very much. Born in 1898 to a wealthy New York family, Peggy Guggenheim was a famous heiress, bohemian and art collector whose life spanned and helped to shape 20th century art. She was an early champion of abstract and surrealist artists, including Max Ernst, Jackson Pollock and Mark Rothko. She was a rebellious and rich woman who forged a path through the cultural worlds of New York and Europe. Peggy is a new novel about her life. It's mostly the work of Canadian author Rebecca Godfrey, who died before she could finish her work. That task fell to Leslie Jemison, her friend and fellow writer, and I'm delighted that Leslie joins me now on the line. Leslie, you're very welcome back to Arena.
It's lovely to be back, and really an honour and a pleasure to talk about this extraordinary book, whose process was unlike anything I've worked on before.
Yes, because you were on to us, you were with us, I think, in February talking about your own memoir, Splinter. So it's not often you yourself is in the position where you talk about a book you've finished but haven't begun.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, Rebecca Godfrey, who is really the author and the mind and the spirit behind this novel, was a good friend of mine, and we had many conversations about the book during the years of our friendship. So I had a real sense of why she was drawn to Peggy Guggenheim as a figure, why she wanted to write this book as a novel. She herself was an accomplished writer of fiction and nonfiction. But it was a truly daunting task to try to finish work that she had started and work that meant so much to her.
But you knew that she wanted completed. You knew she didn't want the book to be left uncompleted.
Absolutely. And I feel that it was a gift she left to everybody in her life, the clarity of her wishes around the novel and the fact that if, you know, she had been working on this book, she had been working on Peggy for more than a decade. She had been sick for years by the time she died, and she continued to work in a kind of an amazing, truly astounding way. She continued to give herself to this book. But she knew there was a chance. She wanted desperately to finish it before she died, but she knew there was a chance she wouldn't get to do that.
Well, I'm sure
I'm sure
she'd be very happy with who she passed the baton to, Leslie. Oh. Now, Peggy Guggenheim is a fascinating figure in her own right. She was born into a family well known for its tragedies and for its wealth. The novel begins with a very public tragedy, the death of Peggy's father, Benjamin, on the Titanic in 1912.
Absolutely. Peggy Guggenheim was an extraordinary woman for many reasons, not the least of which is that her life interacted with these large historical events in kind of extraordinary ways. Her father died on the Titanic. Peggy was instrumental in saving major works of art when the Nazis invaded France in World War II. Like, her life was entwined with history in these kind of incredible ways. But yes, she had, you know, her character, especially as Rebecca imagined her character in the novel, she really revered her father. He was a complicated man, absent for portions of her childhood. When he died on the Titanic, he was with his mistress, you know, not a perfect man, but Peggy, and again, especially as Rebecca imagined Peggy, really loved this way that his imagination kind of reached for the stars. Like, he didn't dream small, he dreamed big. And the same was true for Peggy.
And he acted impeccably, according to him and according to witnesses, I think, on the Titanic.
Yeah, he was saving folks as it went down. And, you know, and certainly Peggy's complicated relationship to many men is a part of the novel, her relationship to her father, her relationship to her first husband, the artist Lawrence Vale. And the two of them had a very tempestuous marriage in Paris in the south of France in the 1920s. The kind of third section of the book finds Peggy in a volatile but very meaningful love affair with the author and playwright Samuel Beckett. So her entanglements with various men, as well as her deep and enduring friendships with a number of kind of extraordinary women, are some of the major emotional tides of the book.
All right. Well, we obviously, as Irish readers, are dying to know about the connection with Samuel Beckett. But it was Lawrence Vale and that relationship that brought her to the Paris of the 1920s. And that was a Paris where surrealism and the Dada art movement were all a flutter. And it was a very creative time in Paris.
Yeah, I dare anyone to do too much reading into Paris in the 1920s and not immediately want to find a way to somehow go back and inhabit that time, because, I mean, no era of history is without its flaws and its pain, but there was a deep feeling of creative energy. And yes, Peggy, a big part of her story was that she broke from the world of her childhood, which was this, you know, world of New York aristocratic money and mores. And when she chose to go and build a life with Lawrence Vale in Paris, she was choosing a different kind of world. She was choosing a more bohemian world. She was choosing a world devoted to creativity, to invention, to breaking with traditions in lifestyle and in art making. So that was sort of one of the major movements of her life.
Yes. So, and the people in surrealism at that time would have been Man Ray. Was Max Ernst in Paris at that time? Was what other people in surrealism, or are there different periods of her life? Let's say, when did Jackson Pollock come into her life?
Yeah, so some of her relationships to, acquiring Jackson Pollock's work, acquiring the work of surrealists like Max Ernst and Leonora Carrington, entered her life at a slightly later stage when the novel Peggy ends just before the advent of World War II. And during World War II, after Peggy Guggenheim, who was, of course, herself Jewish, fled after the invasion of the Nazis, she not only helped a number of important works of art survive the war, but she also relocated to New York, which was not a city that she had wanted to return to. She loved Europe. She didn't want to be in the United States. But she set up a gallery during the war in New York called Art of This Century that was this kind of incredible meeting of European and American art. And that's where she put on, you know, Jackson Pollock's first solo show, where she had a room dedicated to abstract expressionism. She had a room dedicated to surrealism. So that's outside the frame of the novel. I think Rebecca was quite smart to choose her terrain. You could write 16 novels about the life of Peggy Guggenheim, but she chose to end just before the advent of the war with these two kind of major events in Peggy Guggenheim's life: the opening of her first gallery, Guggenheim June, in London in 1939, and this love affair with Samuel Beckett, which happened around the same time.
So when she meets Samuel Beckett, Beckett is working with James Joyce as his assistant, as his secretary.
Yes, yeah. And so, you know, it's a funny thing to sort of meet Samuel Beckett before he was Samuel Beckett. I mean, of course, he was Samuel Beckett then as well, but he didn't have the reputation, and he was in this position where he was a bit, he was both part of this very exciting intellectual and creative world, but also he was not there in his full glory. You know, he's living in a cheap apartment in Paris. He was, you know, basically taking dictation for James Joyce. He was getting catastrophically drunk already, but not yet in the context of being a sort of a major and revered artist. But what I love about Rebecca's vision for their love affair, which is not the same vision that you would find in, say, most biographies of Samuel Beckett that sort of treat his love affair with Peggy Guggenheim as a parenthetical and sometimes a bit of a pathetic one. You know, Peggy Guggenheim had relationships with many men. She slept with many men. It was a part of her reputation in the art world, a part of her reputation. She did quite a bit to aid and abet. But Rebecca really saw something in Peggy and Samuel Beckett's relationship that was quite meaningful. And, you know, this is to some extent where the prerogatives of writing this as a novel rather than a work of nonfiction come into play. But she really understood them as two people, both of whom felt a bit misunderstood and underrecognized by the world, and that they saw something in each other before the rest of the world could see it in them.
Yes, and how does Rebecca imagine the love affair progressing?
So she imagines it as, and I should say this is where we sort of got into some of the terrain with the book, where she had left notes behind, she had communicated a lot of her thoughts and intentions, she had left drafted manuscript pages, but this some of the material where I was working with, everybody's impressions of what her vision for this final movement for the movie, but reconstructing it a bit. But I think what she thought at the core of their relationship was two people who had a great deal of mutual respect for each other. They loved to talk, they loved to banter. There was a sense of intellectual connection between these two quick, nimble minds. There was, you know, a lot of sex, but that also there was a lot of volatility. You know, Samuel Beckett was involved with other women. They would sort of go in and out of each other's lives for about a year or so. The novel really focuses on the first flush of their romance, the beginning of it when they were kind of first becoming captivated, compelled by each other.
And how much do you think that affair is imagined by Rebecca, and how much is real?
Well, the affair certainly happened, and there's, you know, quite a bit of writing about it in Peggy Guggenheim's own memoirs. Peggy Guggenheim published three different versions of her own memoirs, actually, and so you can reconstruct some of the places where they spent time, you know, friends' apartments in Paris. They took a trip to Dijon. There were, you know, there was a lot between them. And there are certainly very vivid descriptions of what Peggy Guggenheim was compelled by in Beckett in her own accounts of their love. So I think Rebecca was sort of working with some of those threads, working with the ways that Peggy Guggenheim was articulating a certain kind of fascination with Beckett's mind, and sort of carrying that into the realm of fiction. As a writer, Peggy Guggenheim herself was not terribly introspective. If you read her memoirs, there's not a lot of deep, you know, subjective excavation of her own psyche. And in a way, that leaves a lot of room for a fiction writer who's writing a dramatization of her life to sort of imagine all the things that Peggy Guggenheim herself wasn't saying about her own interiority in her memoirs.
Yes, but her excitement about art and her wish to encourage and propel artists was core to her.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, it's not just left behind in her accounts of her own life, but I mean, it's really her legacy for the world. As part of the process of working on this book, Rebecca went to Peggy Guggenheim's permanent art collection and her Palazzo in Venice. And I actually went there as well. And I mean, it's just an incredible place because you can see the physical embodiment of, you know, Peggy Guggenheim's commitment to art and really what her legacy is, a huge part of her legacy in the art world, that she that it's her, you know, it's her gift that she recognized, collected, and preserved the work of so many important 20th century artists.
Well, Leslie, it's a joy to talk to you as ever. And Peggy Guggenheim's story, going from the Gilded Age to those wonderful years in Paris, it's a fantastic story and a great accomplishment for you and your co-writer, Rebecca Godfrey. Leslie Jemison, thank you so much. Peggy is out now, published by John Murray. Gustav Holst's The Planets is a suite of seven movements with a magnitude of musicality between each planetary theme score, from the warlike Mars to the exuberant and jovial Jupiter. One conductor who will be taking the baton to Holst's landmark suite is Peter Joyce, as part of the Esker Festival Orchestra's performance of The Planets in the National Concert Hall on Sunday, the 18th of August. The work will be presented in concert with a programme of other work, including a world premiere of a Tom Lane composition and arrangements from Arnold Schoenberg and Edward Elgar. Conductor Peter Joyce and cellist Zoe Nagel, who will be leading the Elgar recital, join me now from the Galway studio, but let's start with some Gustav Holst from the planets. This is Uranus the Magician. Well, that was a taste of the planets. That was Opus 32, the sixth movement, Uranus, the Magician, as performed by the Philharmonia Orchestra. And I said I'm joined in the Galway studio by Peter Joyce and cellist Zoe Nagel. Peter, straight to you for your reaction to what I believe is one of your favourite movements from the planets. Is that right?
That's right. Firstly, thanks for having us. It's a pleasure to be here. I think one of the most amazing thing about the planets as a suite that you mentioned, as a large work, is how each movement has such variety. There's really, Holst actually said himself that he didn't plan on having any connection between the movements. There's no symphonic structure in that sense. And so each movement just tries to capture a certain character. And for me, Uranus is one of my favorites because it's just shows unbridled fun in the end, and it turns into a huge march, almost reminding us a little bit of the Sorcerer's Apprentice.
And how does he approach the other ones? I think Neptune, for example, has a choral arrangement.
That's right. Every planet in the planets is actually composed after the astrological character of the planets. So it's not a astronomical piece in Holst's own conception. He was very interested in astrology and wanted to compose movements that captured the kind of character of the astrological figures. And he does that through various musical means, as you said, the very warlike character of Mars, which features this huge, heavy march with lots of brass, right up to the kind of mysterious, unknown aspect of Neptune, which he captures incredibly well with an offstage female chorus right at the end, right at the close of the whole piece.
So I guess Jupiter is the most known, is that right?
It certainly is, specifically because the middle theme became used in throughout England specifically, but all over the world as a kind of a nationalistic hymn. I vow to thee, my country. And it's interesting because it's actually an association that Holst himself wasn't particularly a big fan of. But that through that hymn and through the kind of stirring character of that tune, it's become incredibly famous all through the world.
And do we know, was he interested in astronomy, or did he just think he had a good idea and he went with it?
Well, he was very interested in astrology. He was very interested in a lot of kind of unusual Eastern philosophies, astrology. At the time, things like mysticism were very, very popular. And he really did his research and learned how to read horoscopes and really put a lot of effort. It became a very important hobby for him.
Now, you have an orchestra to bring us the planets. Tell us a little about the Esker Festival Orchestra.
That's right. Being a conductor without an orchestra is not the most fun. And I'm very lucky that I get to conduct the absolutely fantastic Esker Festival Orchestra. And this year, an 80-piece orchestra made up of young professional musicians, advanced students from all over Ireland and now from all over the world, who come together each year, each summer in Galway to rehearse and then perform concerts all over Ireland.
Now, you have a Zoe Nagel with you, and Zoe, you're a cellist and you're going to perform for us shortly. Maybe you might tell us about your first piece of music.
Hi. So
you're
I will be
welcome.
Performing. Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be performing Elgar's Cello Concerto with Peter and the Esker Festival Orchestra. And you'll hear, I believe, two short excerpts from that. But this concerto is really, it's a real staple in the cello repertoire. It's an absolutely, especially the opening, it's a monumental statement. And I think what makes it so special for me to play it, and why I feel so lucky to be able to play it, is not only is it really beautiful music, but it's also, once we kind of know the context behind the writing of it, Elgar's writing of it, it becomes even more touching. So it was the last major work that he created before his death. It followed, it was directly followed the end of World War One. So the whole world, and especially England, was really suffering from this huge, just black cloud, this aftermath of the war. And Elgar was very affected by that. He was generally a man who looked to the world around him for his inspiration. He was a big nature appreciator, and I think you can really hear that in his music.
Let's listen to Zoe Nagel now playing Edward Elgar's Cello Concerto in E minor. This is Opus 85. That's so moving. That's Zoe Nagel, the cellist there, performing Edward Elgar's Cello Concerto in E minor. Peter, talked to us about that piece that Zoe performed so beautifully.
I mean, you hear it from the beginning. It's such an iconic opening. It's such a dramatic, I think, impassioned piece that then immediately changes into such a nostalgic mood. And I think that's one of the things that Zoe mentioned that's so touching about this piece is a nostalgia for a past time. I think it's quite interesting to, and it was very interesting for me to choose this piece and to work on it in context with the Holst, for example, because they're both composed relatively around the same period. Holst started actually writing The Planets first, just before the First World War, which makes actually the military power of the Mars movement, for example, an amazing almost premonition of what was coming. And then to see Holst dealing with this conflict as it continued, and to look outward essentially into space, whereas Elgar with this concerto is really looking back into an idealized past, I think. And that's one of the most touching aspects of this piece.
And you're also doing music from Tom Lane, who we know so well, who does music for theatre.
That's right. We are absolutely delighted to be performing the world premiere of a new work that we commissioned from Tom to actually complete, if you will, the planets. Because Tom's piece is called Earth, the Cradle of Life. And we commissioned it with the idea of writing an Earth movement for the planets, because, of course, due to the astrological nature of the planets, there is no Earth movement. And Tom has written an absolutely fantastic piece that does its best to express actually the foundations of life and the development of the planet and the development of the only life we know in the entire universe, actually.
So that's called Earth, the Cradle of Life, and that's by Tom Lane. So Zoe is now going to perform another piece, and it's again from Edward Elgar's Cello Concerto in E minor. Zoe Nagel there playing the opening of the second movement of Edgar Elgar's Cello Concerto. So Zoe, are you looking forward to performing this with Peter on the baton?
Absolutely. It's so Peter and I know each other already, but it's always just so exciting to take a piece and be afforded the luxury of being able to spend a few days rehearsing and working on it together and really collaborating, and then producing something at the end that is unique to the process that we've shared together. So I feel very lucky, and I'm really, really looking forward to the weekend. So
we can all see the Esker Concert Orchestra in their upcoming concert this weekend on Sunday, August 17th at 8 p.m. in the Galway Cathedral. More information from EskerFestivalOrchestra.com. And on Sunday, August the 18th at 3 p.m. in the National Concert Hall in Dublin. More information about that for the Dublin date in nch.ie. Now we have the competition winner. You know the question was which Beatle performed the theme song from the James Bond film Live and Let Die, and the winner will be able to go to the RTE Concert Orchestra as they do the musical world of Bond, James Bond, at the National Concert Hall while staying in the Spencer Hotel. And the winner is Stephen MacDonald from Castlebar in County Mayo. So congratulations to you, Stephen, and enjoy that. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Barbara Rose-Sanmo, Paul and Paula Sheehy. Harry Buckless was on sound. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Nasa McLaughlin. And John Creedon is next.